It's the solemnized edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, the real Noah's Ark, repressive blasphemy laws, beyond secularism in Chilliwack, and an interview with CFI Indiana about the right to solemnized weddings. Let's begin episode 193.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So Ian, great news this week. It looks like creationists are finally starting to employ the scientific method.
Really?
Well, apparently in the Netherlands, there is a full-scale replica of Noah's Ark being open. It cost over $1 million, and it's built to 300 cubits by 500 by 330 cubits. So in modern, that's about 130 meters by 29 meters by 23 meters. Pretty big. The ark actually will also have life-size animals displayed aboard, including a pair of faked elephants, some chickens, which apparently chickens are real. They go around, cluck, cluck. The ship, of course, holds information about the biblical story. It houses two cinemas for special events and boasts a restaurant, and it can barely have up to like 3,000 visitors a day. Apparently the whole project began, this is actually the second one they built. They built a smaller version of this a few years ago, and then they were inspired somehow to build a full-size replica. Apparently it all began with a nightmare in 1992 when the low-lying Netherlands were flooding, which they do on occasion. Its creator, Johan Hubars, thought that new floods were possible, and that this was sort of some harbinger of the great apocalypse that you get in the Old Testament. And of course, he also blamed global warming, so a little green in there. He wanted to bring the ark alive to sort of show people that, you know, that there's hope in the world, that, you know, even in the worst of times, we can survive. And, of course, to promote religion. So he's not really a scientist. I kind of lied to you on that one. Now, again, above and beyond the sort of religious proselytizing thing, if you think about it, you know, 3,000 people a day at $10 a head, which is about $30,000 a day running at full tilt, which might be some form of a motivation. I mean, it could really pay for itself in less than a month, a little over a month.
Right.
So what I like about this and why I thought it was interesting, besides like, oh my God, what a waste of $1 million, unless it's, like I say, really a business venture, in which case I guess it's no worse than Disneyland. But now you can literally prove, or I guess in this case disprove, that you could actually fit two of every animal. So, I mean, before it was kind of a abstract concept. You could do the math, but now you can go there and you can physically see, oh my God, that's full of crap. You could never have done this. Noah's flood must be fake, at least as described in the Bible.
Well, the Bible is known for getting little details wrong.
Yes, just small ones, like
little
the
things,
sun
yeah.
going around the earth.
Yeah, little details. Well, speaking of little details, yesterday, on Monday the 10th, I made a trek out to Chilliwack, which, for those of you who don't know, Chilliwack is sort of in the BC Bible Belt, because they were hosting a town hall discussion called Beyond Secularism, and it was convened by the NDP MLA Gwen Mahoney. And I thought, okay, well, that sounds interesting. I should go out to this because I am a secularist and I want to know what's beyond me. So I trekked out there with some other Vancouver skeptics, and the panel that was assembled featured three Christians, Bill Blakey, Ron Dart, and Paul Rowe. And as he pointed out at the time, which was kind of odd for a talk called Beyond Secularism, and there were no secularists on the panel, let alone the fact that the posters for the event had religious symbols from five different religions and yet only three Christians were on the panel. Also, a little odd. But it was an interesting evening. I mean, For one thing, for those of you who are not familiar with BC politics, the NDP are on the political left. So it was odd to hear religious rhetoric coming from the political left.
Well, one thing to take note of, and I'm not sure if you're going to mention this later, but the NDP has a lot of its roots in social theology, right? The idea of liberation theology, that's what I'm looking for. And a lot of the original founders were actually ministers and preachers and all that who were religious, but they were left-wing religious. You know, like the people need to have power, and the government itself would be like the Pope, and we need to get rid of the Pope, and we need the people to find their own way.
Right. Well, Tommy Douglas, the founder of the NDP party, was a minister who went around kind of a Bible-thumping kind of guy. Anyway, the thing that sort of set this apart was the discussion whether or not, quote, secularism has gone too far, which I was kind of curious how the panelists would describe secularism. And no surprise, they basically came up with sort of like straw man versions, and they kept changing the definition over the evening. And they sort of came up with the conclusion they're okay with secularism as long as it's secularism that they agree with. There was really no understanding of the role or purpose or how secularism is instituted, separating politics and religion. It was more sort of they would shift around from, you know, there's one kind of secularism that we all agree is important. And then there's, of course, you know, the evil secularism that wants to destroy religion and stamp out personal freedom and all that kind of stuff, which, I mean, is ludicrous. And so they're going around and they're kind of shifting their terms, and it really wasn't all that impressive. It was actually kind of depressing to see some of these college professors banding about straw man arguments.
I would have actually hoped that they would have had a much better nuanced argument, because, I mean, obviously one of the things that people on the left, especially socialists, have to contend with is the whole idea of atheistic communism and how that is seen as a very oppressive and repressive version of the left wing, and you think they would have sort of addressed that idea as opposed to, as you're saying, this sort of straw man shifting the goalpost, flim-flam almost, of a discussion?
Yeah, I mean, there were some interesting statements that were made, particularly from Paul Rowe, who I think was probably the more conservative of the three panel members. He made some interesting statements. One thing that he said that I thought was funny was that he remarked how he would not want to live in a world that John Lennon imagined in the song Imagine, which I thought was kind of a weird thing to say.
Yeah.
He also talked about how, and I think his exact quote, I'm going to paraphrase as best I remember, but he was sort of saying, some people, you know, don't need religion to motivate them to give to charity, but I do. And I was just sort of like, I kind of like laughed to myself, like, you just sort of insulted yourself. Like,
yeah. Well, it goes up there with the whole idea that a lot of people claim that, you know, atheists have no moral core at them, that, you know, that without religion, people would just go around and kill people and they'd rape and they'd pillage, which of course says a lot more about them than it ever does about other people. Because in a weird sort of way, as an atheist, my ethical views and the fact that I don't go around and kill and all that implies there's a strength of character that I know those are wrong and I will not do those, where there's the implicit argument that if you're a religious person, the only thing holding you back is that you're worried that Big Daddy in the sky is going to smack you around. But if you had the opportunity...
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of cliche remarks. Ron Dart at some point said how there's, you know, other ways of knowing things beyond science. And, you know, there was a few sort of nauseating moments like that. But that being said, there were actually some impressive moments as well. One person during the Q&A, one person got up. He was dressed in Greek Orthodox attire, like the whole shebang, hat, everything. And he was the most hardcore secularist there. And he was like, I am an ardent secularist. I do not want government and religion anywhere near each other. And, like, that was surprising. You don't usually expect to see that.
Well, you see, I think this is one of the things, and you get this a lot in the United States, because quite often they mention, you know, the separation of church and state. And then they also say, well, you know, the United States is a Christian country, at least it was when it was founded. And those two things are sort of important because that's true. But the kind of Christianity you had in there were a lot of different denominations. And the original colonies were actually theocracies. A lot of them were theocracies, very hardcore. So the idea of the separation of church and state, or secularism as we're referring to it, isn't so much to repress any, isn't so much to repress religion, but to ensure that the state has no role in religion, ergo promoting one over another. I mean, it's not so much a denial of religion, although I think me and you would agree with that. But you don't want to, well, let's say if Harper turned out to be a secret Muslim and he suddenly dictated as the government that everyone in Canada had to be a Muslim, right? That would be very offensive to a lot of people. And it's intended, the separation of church and state is intended to prevent a government from ever doing something like that. So by being removed from religion, you're actually protecting the religious freedoms of those people who have those views.
Exactly. And that was sort of the point that I think a lot of the skeptics in the audience were trying to make in the Q&A. And I think to a certain extent, the panelists didn't necessarily disagree. It was more sort of like, well, that's a very, you know, that's a kind of secularism that, of course, everybody likes. We're talking about, you know, Stalinist secularism, which I think kind of misses the whole point again.
Well, and sorry, just quickly on that one point is, I mean, Stalinist Russia was a theocratic state in the sense that it worshipped Stalin. So,
yeah.
I mean, it was a religious state. It just wasn't a traditional religious state.
Yeah. There were a couple of interesting moments where one member of the audience was a very conservative man, got up and sort of accused the NDP of not supporting traditional family values or valuing, he said this, valuing owls and trees over human beings. And it was actually, I kind of appreciated the way that the host, Gwen O'Malley Mahoney, and Blakey responded. They're both NDPers. They're pretty like, you know, you need an environment to have families. Can't really have one or the other. And it was a pretty good response. So, I mean, it was actually surprising in that it wasn't as conservative as we might have expected. And they did seem inclined to have more of these that did involve secularists or other religions as well. So it gives us an interesting view into religion on the left. And that's something we don't necessarily hear about a lot in Canada.
No, I think quite often we fall into the trope that, you know, just because you're a conservative, you must be a fundamentalist religious person. And just because you're a socialist or leftist, you must be a godless atheist. And that misses a lot of the nuance that's in between there. I mean, in the United States, you see this a lot more than you do here, I think, because they're much more vocal. But you have a lot of progressive socialist people who are deeply religious people, and they actually use their faith as the reason for their socialism. And conversely, I mean, there are a number of people who are hard right-wingers, and I would put Penn Jillette up there and Michael Shermer, who, I mean, granted, they're libertarian, but they're right-wing libertarians, and they have no faith or belief behind them. So you're right. There's a lot of more nuance there than we tend to think with our quick little cliches.
Absolutely. Let's go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Empowers you. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So, Ethan, apparently laws penalizing blasphemy, apostasy, and defamation of religion are worldwide and widespread. A Pew Research Center on the Forum for Religion and Public Life found that in 2011, almost half the countries and territories of the world have laws or policies that penalize blasphemy, apostasy, and defamation. Just for those who aren't sure what apostasy is, that's when you belong to one faith and you say, screw it, I quit and I want to go to another one, or I just quit in general. Of the 198 countries studied, 32 have anti-blasphemy laws, 20 have laws that penalize apostasies, and a whopping 44% have laws against defamation of religion. Now, it should be noted that included in the defamation is hate speech against members of a particular religious group. So this is one of those sort of slippery slopes. For example, if someone goes out and calls for the execution of Pastafarians, that's not really blasphemy, that's like a hate crime. However, if someone points out that, I don't know, a miracle is not really a miracle, and they get charged for deliberate and malicious acts intended at outraging religious feelings, that's my Indian reference, well, that's actually not hate speech. To me, that's a public service announcement against charlatans. Now, the countries that have anti-apostate laws that make it illegal to leave the faith are pretty much exclusively Muslim countries, which I guess is no great surprise there. The anti-blasphemy laws, though, extend beyond this area and include countries that we don't normally think of as intolerant in that sort of sense. So Germany, Italy, the UK, Ireland, Netherlands, Denmark, and a few other ones. Although, again, you have to dig underneath a little bit. Netherlands has a law, anyone who publicly, orally, or in writing, or depiction, offends religious feelings by scornful blasphemy, would be illegal. That being said, they haven't actually used the law forever, and actually I just read that in the last month or so they actually repealed that law.
Hmm.
It's a good thing.
Good.
In the UK, they have common law that makes it an offense to have blasphemy, but again, a recent Privy Court ruling said that that doesn't apply to stage or to broadcast media, so it's been one of those things. I think the last time they had a conviction on that was in the 70s.
I mean, Speaker's Corner alone would give them plenty of material to litigate against.
Exactly. And like in Italy, you know, which again, a heavily Catholic country, you'd expect it there. But again, it's only a misdemeanor.
Hmm.
Ireland, though, has a pretty hardcore one than the other big Catholic one. In fact, most of the European laws on blasphemy date back to the 1930s or a little before that and have a lot of Nazi influence on them. And most of them that I could find in my research haven't been used for like 50 or 60 years. So, however, that being said, I think Poland, which has quite a bad law, actually it states this one here. Whoever offends religious feelings of other people by publicly insulting an object of religious cult or a place for public holding of religious ceremonies is subject to a fine, restriction of liberty, or loss of liberty for up to 2 years. And this is, I think it's a recent law that they have actually passed there. I'm pretty sure the communist era did not have this, so
right.
And in an odd way, it's actually worse than the old laws. So another one place that I found, and again, do you expect this or not? In Israel, they have more or less the same law that they passed in 1928 under the British mandate, which states that any person who utters a word or sound in public or within earshot of any other person that may be or so is intended to offend the religious sensitivities or faith can be expected to be found guilty and eligible to 1 year jail sentence. So 100 years ago, you went for 1 year. Now you go for 2 years, depending on where you are.
Hmm.
And I must admit, this is one of those things where I have to wonder about the application of the law. There's a big difference between it's against the law and actually being charged. Because I can't help but think that in Israel that there'd be a heck of a lot of religious sensitivities bothered on all fronts. So those other countries sort of that have the defamation laws. So now we're going from blasphemy laws to defamation laws. That includes almost all of Europe and even Canada. Of course, again, I think this category needs to be defined a bit better because there is a difference, again, in how the laws of pride is written, with the special exception of perhaps Germany, which, of course, has its Nazi past and they get treated a little different than everyone else. There hasn't actually been what I would consider to be defamation in the religious sense of it, as opposed to hate speech. I mean, even here in Canada, we had something that came close to it a couple of times with the photos, and I believe there was an article about a book that Macleans had published, and those were challenged as hate speech. but they weren't actually challenged as defamation. It's more what they call blasphemy libel than it is blasphemy laws. The report does point out that that these particular motions, these laws, are actually somewhat on the decrease in democratic countries, provided you exclude the Arab Spring countries, which is sort of one of the ironies. And there, they haven't moved back so much as they've moved their... How do I put this? The dictatorships that they've replaced, the dictatorships used blasphemy laws and that sort of thing to reinforce their dictatorship. And now they're getting democratic governments in there, quote-unquote democratic governments, but like we've been hearing about Egypt, those are very religiously orientated governments which want to reinforce the sort of religious mandate. And I will point out that in a number of Muslim countries, apostasy is actually a death sentence. But that being said, the report points out that they couldn't find actually anyone who had been in the last like 50 or 100 years killed for apostasy in and of itself. Although that charge had been applied to other crimes, so maybe not quite in the clear.
Right.
It also showed, and this again I thought was interesting, but then maybe not that surprising, that of the 20 Middle Eastern countries, 15 had defamation laws and 13 had blasphemy laws. So again, there's a strong religious team there. Whereas in Europe, they had, out of the 45 countries that included, 36 of them had defamation laws, but only 8 had blasphemy laws. So again, I think the idea of defamation in that sense was more, again, intended against hate speech. In fact, it pointed out that, and it pointed out that in a lot of the, well, I'm going to say more fundamentalist religious countries. I don't want to just include Muslims, although the article did only mention them. That in those countries, defamation of religion was a crime, but you could actually denigrate or you could actually have hate speech against particular groups or religions. And there was a big separation between that view versus the European view. But I'm sure that's because Europe's had much more horrific experience with, I don't know, the Jews. So that I thought was interesting. Now, of course, while I was doing research for this, I had come up with some other aspects. I mean, these laws, they have impact. We discussed the Pakistani girl who was accused of burning the Quran and was later found out that was pretty much framed. There's the ongoing ordeal of the Indian skeptic who has fled his country for the crime of explaining that the weeping Madonna was really a leaky septic tank.
Mm.
And a few may have heard about this one, a Greek man who was charged with, quote, malicious blasphemy and religious insult on the known social networking site Facebook. What he did was created a Facebook page for the elder Pastasio the Pastafarian. This, of course, is a morphing of Pastafarian images with local Eastern Orthodox religious icon, Elder Pasios. What he did essentially was take the image of the real monk and replace it with a bunch of spaghetti. If you look at it, actually, it's kind of a disturbing image, but it's also kind of funny. He's got this funny white beard, but there's all spaghetti behind him. We'll have the picture on our website in the show notes. The monk himself died in 1994, and although he hasn't been beatified, so he's not technically a saint, he's pretty much treated that way by the religious people in Greece itself. There's been actually a number of books that have been written on him based upon his life and his prophecies, but those books themselves are part of the problem because they range from anywhere from How to Raise Your Child, The Apocalypse. There's even a dive book that's out there on him. The creator of the page said it's intended to be satire, and the idea is to criticize not the religion so much, but the commercialization of the monk, right? And that's the real big thing. This was actually spurred on by the recent election where the Golden Dawn Party, a neo-fascist party, earned some seats in the Greek parliament. It was at their urging that the charges were laid against the Facebook page creator. The case, of course, is still pending, and I would expect that the Greek law and the Greek law will sort of work its way out. This is not seen so much as serious, it's more of a nuanced thing.
Right.
But one great quote I got from a Greek law professional and constitutional expert on that said, obviously the law is irrational, since God doesn't need to be protected by any criminal code. Kind of like that little ending on it.
Yeah, that's fairly well put. Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker? When we come back, we're going to have an interview with CFI Indiana's Reba Wooden, who's going to be talking about their legal battle over the ability to solemnize marriages.
Solemnize, not the other one.
That's right. Okay. That's right. Stay tuned.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Reba Boyd-Wooden, the Executive Director of CFI Indiana. Thanks for joining us, Reba.
Yes, it's a pleasure.
So you guys are involved in a legal battle over the right to perform marriage solemnization. What's the current status of this in Indiana? How does one go about getting their marriage officially solemnized and recognized?
Okay, in order to get a legal marriage in Indiana, which is only opposite sex because we're not same-sex friendly yet, you have to go get a marriage license at usually the courthouse or the county clerk in whatever county you live in or what county you want to get married in. And then you do that. They certify that you're a proper person, proper couple to be married and all this stuff. And then you have to go this next step, which is called getting it solemnized. And the law in Indiana states who can solemnize a marriage, which basically means officially sign the marriage certificate to make the marriage legal. It says that basically any, the clergy person of any religion can do it. And then it lists certain religions that for some reason they have singled out because maybe some people don't think they're religions, I don't know what, but or they don't have clergy, but they have quite a list there, but they're all religions. And then the other category is civil officials. And the civil officials in Indiana, the only ones who can do that are clerks, judges, or mayors. Now, it doesn't exactly state this in the law, but I know in practicality, anybody who is an attorney in Indiana, officially licensed in Indiana as an attorney, can become solemnized as a judge for a day, and then they can sign it and solemnize it. Well, that's the way it exists right now. Now, Center for Inquiry has a training program for what we call secular celebrants. And we do ceremonies for people, but we are not included. I mean, there's nothing says we can't do it. It's just we aren't on the list.
Right.
We don't qualify as a civil official or as a religious clergy. So our suit is all about trying to get the state to recognize our secular celebrants as being able to solemnize the marriage, which again means, in plain English, it means to sign the marriage certificate.
Right. So why is this an issue for secular humanists? I mean, if they can get their marriage solemnized by a government official, why should CFI be concerned about this?
Well, our contention is, and that's what makes it a problem in the court too, is they say, well, we're not keeping you from getting married. That's true. But we feel that if a clergy person, a person who's religious, can go to their clergy person and take care of it all in one step, their clergy person can perform a nice ceremony for them and they can solemnize, you know, officially sign the license, that secular people should have an outlet for that too. And so we're saying that it's not fair. And we filed our suit under the First Amendment to the, it was filed in federal court, Federal District Court, Southern Indiana, and it is under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, the Establishment Clause, and we're claiming that it's privileging religion over non-religion.
Right.
Because religious people can go through it just with their clergy, and non-religious people, while they do have an alternative, it's not the same, and we're saying it's not equal.
Right.
And also under the 14th Amendment, which is the Equal Protection Clause under the law. Now, recently, just actually a little more than a week ago, the decision came down from the Federal District Court, Southern Indiana. Judge Sarah Evans Barker ruled against us. And her decision, which is out online and it's linked, it really shocked me because I thought she was a more liberal-leaning judge in this. I thought she was more church-state friendly, but it's a very right-wing decision. And she basically says that we don't qualify under the Establishment Clause. It's a free exercise case and not establishment. And that the reason for the law, which gives clergy people the right to do this, is because it's accommodating the tradition of marriage, which she says the tradition of marriage is a religious tradition, as accommodating the religious. Now, my own personal opinion is that kind of makes our case, but that's not the way she's looking at it.
Right.
And she even went so far in one statement to say that if she ruled in favor of us and gave us the right to solemnize marriages, it actually would be privileging non-religion over religion, which I could not even see that, because we're not asking her to take away the right of the clergy people. We're just asking to be treated equally. Take away anybody, you know, tell anybody that already has the right to do it that they can't do it. So I have trouble even thinking where she's coming from on that. And also she said that we don't qualify under the 14th Amendment because we are not a class of, we don't qualify as a class of people that's been discriminated against.
As non-believers.
Yeah, as non-believers, right.
Mm-hmm. And what's the difficulty, because there are a humanist organization there that will solemnize a marriage, but they are qualified as a religion. So obviously that creates some conflict with a secular humanist.
Right. And the Humanist Society, which I don't want to disparage them at all. They're a very fine organization. I was certified by the Humanist Society for almost 10 years, I think, 9 or 10 years. And I solemnized over 50 marriages in the state of Indiana, signed the certificates and everything. And it was perfectly legal because the Humanist Society is chartered as a religious organization. Well, you know, that's okay. That's their right to do it. But as secular humanists, we don't want to be classified as a religion.
Right.
And we think that you should not have to have yourself classified as being religious in order to solemnize a marriage. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for the Humanist Society. I don't want any quarrel with them. They are doing fine work. I did it as a matter of being pragmatic because it was a way I could do non-religious weddings for people. I've encouraged CFI and working with Ron Lindsay and others there who agree that we needed to start our own program and litigate for the right for purely secular people to be able to do this. And so we started the program in 2009. We have a regular training program where we train people and certify people. And we do ceremonies for people.
Right.
We have to ask them, you know, explain to them that they have to have somebody who's legal under the law to actually sign the marriage certificate for them. Point to Indiana and say, what's wrong with Indiana? But really, our secular celebrants cannot solemnize a marriage in any state in the United States just under their secular celebrant certification.
Right.
Have some other ways of getting around it, all right, but, and we have one who's an attorney here, and she's done a couple of weddings, and she solemnized them because she's an attorney, and she can get deputized as a judge for the day. So under our certification, we made the stipulation that if you're certified and listed by us as one of our celebrants, and if you can do it under a civil authority in your state, then we said that's okay. But because of the issue we're trying to bring forth, we told people, if you want to be certified by us, then you cannot do it under any religious guise.
Right.
So like in Florida, notaries can do it. So our secular celebrants there can become a notary and do it. California, anybody can become a judge for a day and do it. So a celebrant in California could go through the process of being a judge for a day, and I know that our director, Jim Underdown in L.A., has done that in the past. So that's kind of where we are.
What's the difference between the kind of ceremony that you guys instruct versus the Humanist Society that is classified as a religion? How are the ceremonies different, and why does that make a difference for people who want a truly secular ceremony?
The ceremony would not necessarily be any different at all, because both the Humanist Society and under our secular celebrant program, it's up to the couple as to what kind of ceremony they want.
Right.
They can write their own vows. We have samples that we give them. The samples that I give people are basically the ones I developed when I was under the Humanist Society. There's no set way you have to do it under either of these certifications. So, a person can have a non-religious wedding under the Humanist Society. I mean, they do it all the time. They have celebrants all over the world, actually, I think. And so as far as the ceremony, the actual process is no different. It's just the principle of saying we shouldn't have to say we're religious to do it.
Right. The court has ruled that there's no real issue here in discrimination because you can become a member of the clergy through the internet or you can get a humanist wedding. But obviously, I think your contention and our contention is that as non-believers, it is discrimination because we shouldn't have to jump through more hoops than a religious person does. So what's your response to the court?
To me, it's kind of like the separate is not equal.
Yeah, very well put. So it's actually against the law then for you or for someone else to provide a secular solemnization for a wedding. It does seem like that's very strange.
And that means, you know, you got to be clear about the terminology.
Right.
It's not against the law for me to do the ceremony, but it is against the law for me to actually sign the marriage certificate, which is the process that's called solemnizing. So that's where it is, and it is against the law, and it's a class, I forgot what class it is, if it's a misdemeanor, okay? So, you know, we're not going to, none of us have broken the law, we're not going to. And the state is enforcing the law, which is their job to do, but we just want to get the law changed.
A quote in the court statement that I thought was interesting: we must gently remind plaintiffs that the free exercise clause is not a guarantee against inconvenience. Similarly, the Constitution does not obligate the state of Indiana to perform heroics to fashion plaintiff's ideal remedy. What's your response to that? Because that struck me as a very strange statement.
My response to that was I thought it was very condescending and dismissive.
Yeah.
Because they're calling what we think should be a right for us to be able to do a mere inconvenience. Well, it's a little more than a mere inconvenience. I mean, it's an extra expense. It's an extra step. And that religious people don't have to go through, and it's just not equal. So I really didn't like that statement at all.
Yeah.
The clerk's office is just going to read. They probably have a little pap, short vowel thing that they read. There might be some that would accommodate them if they brought their own in, but it's just going to be a cut-and-dried little thing. In fact, I get stories all the time from people. One of our couples who are members here, who I did their ceremony for them, but when they went to get their marriage license and they wanted to get it solemnized at the courthouse, for one thing, they had trouble scheduling it at a time when there was a judge going to be there to do it, because they both work and they weren't there during the evenings. So they had that problem. And finally, when they did meet up with somebody, they said, well, there's not a judge here, but we have some young attorneys who will let us deputize them as a judge and they'll do it. So they go in and this guy takes them down to the basement in like a break room or something, doesn't even look at them, doesn't even read vows, nothing, signs the marriage certificate, and they said, we looked at each other and said, we're married, that's it. In other words, it was just a cold signing of a paper. It wasn't anything personal.
Right.
And that couple, I did their ceremony for them at a place where they wanted to have it. That's one of the things, you know, they can have it any place they want to if we do it. And she says, we consider the day you did our ceremony as our real wedding, not the one that was signed at the courthouse.
Right.
And then another couple recently went to the courthouse, city county building it is here in Indianapolis, and they had called ahead to arrange to make sure there was a judge there who could sign their marriage certificate, you know, solemnize their marriage. They got there, they got their license, but they have to pay for the license, okay, so then they go to the judge's chamber. Oh, the people in the other one, the first one, the guy charged them $125, okay, just to sign the paper. So this second couple, they go to the judge's chamber. The judge says, I don't have time to do this right now, but my husband's here and he can do it for you. So they said, the husband read, I said we did our vows. It was kind of a short little, you know, probably just generic vow thing, and signed it. And they looked down at it after he'd signed it, and he signed it because you have to sign your, I know from signing 50 of them in the past, you sign your name, you sign your title, and usually then you have to sign the organization you're certified by. Signed it as a minister. Now, most people wouldn't even care, right? Charge them $150. I mean, this is at the, you know, this, they thought it was a civil person. He turned out to be a minister. He signed it. Well, most people wouldn't even care, right? They just want to solemnize, so it would just gone through. But this couple looked at it, and they were livid. They said, we do not want our marriage solemnized by a minister. So the judge comes out, takes it back, prints a whole new certificate for him, and she signed it and put her seal on it and charged him more money. That's the kind of treatment people get. I mean, I know it varies, right? But this is, it's just a cut and dried, mostly generic ceremony.
Absolutely. And CFI has appealed this ruling, obviously.
Yes, we're appealing.
Right. And the timetable, do you think, before there could be some kind of resolution?
Well, it could be a long time, according to my information. Our lead attorney is Ken Falk, who is the legal director for ACLU of Indiana, which we were very happy to get him to take the case. We feel we have probably the best civil liberties lawyer we could have in this state. So he's working on the appeal right now. It'll be appealed to the Seventh Circuit, which meets in Chicago. Seventh Circuit takes in three states, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. Our brief is due the 15th of January, so he's probably working on this as we speak. We'll be putting that together. He was estimating, from his past experience, that probably it won't be heard in the Seventh Circuit until at least May. That's just his estimate. There's no definite date set. We do have a case number now and, you know, dates along the line for when things are due. We have to submit our brief, and then the state of Indiana, which is the state attorney general's office. Tom Fisher is the lead attorney for the state. He's a solicitor general of the state of Indiana. He has a time period to submit his. So Ken's estimate is it probably won't be heard till at least May. And then he said he's waited a year or more to find out the decision from the courts on cases. So it could be, you know, a year or more or so before we know the outcome of it.
And in your opinion, what would be the best resolution for this case?
Well, the best resolution is that we just get added to the list and are allowed to solemnize the marriages. We're not asking for any kind of damages or anything like that. We're just asking to be added to the list of people who are legal to solemnize.
And in the meantime, what would you recommend for couples who do want a secular marriage in Indiana? What would their best course of action be?
Well, my recommendation, of course, I'm partial toward our celebrants. I mean, other options are they can go with somebody from the Humanist Society to get it all in one step. I think there's one person in Indiana maybe certified there. I used to be, but I gave up the certification in order to get involved in the other. So my recommendation is, you know, contact us. We will explain the process to you. We are very happy to do your ceremony for you. But we recommend that when you get your marriage license at the courthouse, at the clerk's office, then any county in Indiana, whichever one you plan on doing this in, there will be somebody there, usually, or you can arrange for somebody to be there, a clerk or a judge, who will solemnize it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, what you have to do. I mean, of course, nothing, we aren't going to tell the couple they can't go have a minister sign it either, but, you know, we would prefer they go the civil route.
Of course,
but that's
right.
Up to them. It's up to them. So that's our recommendation. And we have two weddings already lined up right now. I'm doing one. One of our other celebrants has one lined up here in December. Those couples are doing the two-step process. I have at least six couples who are considering having us do it that have weddings coming up here probably within the next year. And, you know, that's up to the couple. If they want to stick with us and do the two-step process, I mean, it doesn't look like we'll have the right to solemnize anytime in the very near future. And if they don't want to do that, then, I mean, some people don't care to have a particular special ceremony. And so just getting it signed at the clerk's office is, you know, having somebody there, a judge or clerk, solemnize it there is fine with them. They don't care about having another step. That's okay. It's up to the person. But the people who do, you know, we can provide the ceremony for them.
Well, I mean, Reva, thanks for talking with us on Radio Free Thinker and telling us about the situation in Indiana. How can listeners go about finding more? Could you give them an email address or a website that they can check out?
Well, if they'll go to the Center for Inquiry website, centerforinquiry.net, and if they click on the Press Center, they'll find our news releases both on when we filed the case back in May. So to find that news release, which has the full case link to it, from the Press Center, they'll have to click on Archives and go to May 2012, and they'll find it there. The one about the decision that came down is probably still on the front page of the Press Center. I also am a blogger for Center for Inquiry. My blog's called Free Thought from the Heartland. And I just wrote a blog last week entitled, Why is Center for Inquiry Challenging This? And I have several links in it. I think that's... And then if they want to know about our training program, because I do workshops for people to become certified by Center for Inquiry, from the same webpage, centerforinquiry.net, if they click on Education tab, go to the right-hand side, and they'll find information about how to become a secular celebrant. I don't have any workshops scheduled right now, but I'm open to scheduling some. I'm going to schedule one probably in the near future. There's also a list of find a secular celebrant, and it tells you where, what states we have secular celebrants in. Now, I had one person come to a workshop I did who was from Canada, but Canada's laws are a little different. And he came to the workshop and took the workshop training, and I think he was going to go through, I think there's some kind of legal process that he can go through in Canada so that he can legally sign licenses.
Reba, thanks for joining us, and good luck with your court case, and we'll please update us when you get a resolution.
Okay, will do. Thanks for having me on.
In the sky, standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR.
You know, Ethan, it's a shame that I missed out on that interview. There are a few things that I thought might have been interesting to raise if, you know, you were psychic and you could read my mind. We kind of talked about it beforehand. One of the things that they're trying to do is they're just trying to expand who is allowed to qualify to solemnize marriage. So right now it's government officials and clergy, and they kind of want to expand that to government officials, clergy, and other noted groups. And they have this, what is it, secular celebrants, right? But you also mentioned in the interview, and I've done my research, that really to become a member of the clergy is kind of a token thing. You can go online and you can get a clergy thing. At which point it kind of seems to be meaningless. I mean, was the sense of this is just that they wanted to give CFI or that sort of group the right to do this? Or was it to point out that the idea of solemnization beyond the legal people, the government people, seemed to be just arbitrary?
Well, you know, I think that the point is more sort of to provide a secular option. I think that some people don't like the idea of having to be ordained, even if it is just a token gesture to perform a wedding ceremony. And I think the goal is for CFI or any other skeptical secular group that does not want to declare itself a religion to have that ability, just like a clergyman would. And given the fact that anybody can go online and get ordained, I mean, it's ludicrous to not provide a secular alternative.
Well, that was one of the things. I mean, the way it was sort of described, the way it sort of is that signature seems to be almost meaningless because of this big, huge loophole they have. In some ways, I'm wondering if this is not sort of the a false road to go down. Same sort of way that same-sex marriage came in, right? That, you know, we want to be married as opposed to a civil union, where a civil union is strictly I get a license from the government and therefore I am legally bound with this person. And the marriage part is more of a social construct. Hmm. And I wonder if actually maybe secularists would be better off if they sort of didn't worry so much about the solemnization idea, but pushed for the idea that marriage in a church means nothing any more than a social convention, that the marriage itself is actually just a civil union and the license you get from a courthouse. So you go to the courthouse, you sign documents, the judge signs a document, you are legally bound together, and that's all you need to be a couple. If you want to have this social celebration, that has nothing to do with the legal implications, so there is no signature needed, and it's merely you going out to the community saying, hey everyone, we're now joined. So you can do it in a church, you can do it at a pasta house with your skeptic friends, or you could do it wherever you want to, and it sort of separates the two.
Yeah, it's a possibility. I don't know if that's practical for the situation in Indiana, which seems to have stricter views on what makes a marriage official. It seems to be that you need to have that solemnization there or else it's just invalid.
No, exactly. And like I say, it's one of those things that a lot of people who are going for same-sex marriage is, do you go for the sort of abolishment of religious marriage altogether, or do you try and get equal rights for same-sex couples to have marriage? But a discussion for another day, perhaps.
Sure. Why don't we go to our skeptical highlights, as we're almost out of time here on the show. My skeptical highlight is coming up on Saturday, December 15th. It's Cafe Inquiry, which is CFI Vancouver's monthly discussion group. This week, it's entitled Positive Thinking for Chronic Pain, Helpful or Harmful? This is happening, as I said, Saturday, December 15th at 1 p.m. in room 1505 of SFU Harbor Center, downtown Vancouver. And the topic about positive thinking for chronic pain will be presented by Marilee Welch. She is the events coordinator for CFI Vancouver. And some of the questions that they'll be asking here is, can positive thinking have an impact on treatment or physiology or recovery? Or can positive thinking simply mask what needs direct medical intervention? So some interesting questions will be raised. No doubt there'll be fascinating discussion. And we, of course, all encourage you to go and join in on that discussion.
I would hope that they might actually want to do an empirical experiment there where they offer half of the group that shows up some opium and they give the other one some positive affirmations and smack both of them in the hand with a hammer or something and see which one says, hey, this kind of works, and no, this one didn't quite work.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
That would be. So it's a big month for coffee because mine are Philosopher's Cafe announcements. So human nature versus animal nature. It's being held Wednesday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Lynn Valley Maine Public Library in North Vancouver. It's free. There is a theory that humans, like all animals, are inherently selfish and competitive, with only a gloss of civilization restraining us. However, some claim that this is untrue and assert that primates and other animals exhibit moral sentiments. Primatologist Franz de Waal will give a short lecture on the matter, and then there will be an open floor to discuss people's view about human versus animal nature. Another philosophy cafe is Science and Religion, an Unholy Alliance. Also being held at the Lynn Valley Main Library in Vancouver, also free, but this is Wednesday. I think this is Monday, December 19th? It's this Monday. I think I got the wrong date here, but I'm pretty sure it's next Monday. Next Monday. Many people believe that science and religion occupy two separate worlds and that never shall the twain meet. And of course, other people, as we talked about earlier, think there's different ways to have truth. We know truth in different ways. they're going to talk about, well, can you actually honor both ideas? Should they both sort of play an equal part in a modern life? And does science kind of cancel out religion? You can join Professor Emeritus in Philosophy and Literature, Graham Frost, as he discusses this issue and moderates a forum on the subject. I don't think I'm going to agree with Frost, because I get a hint from the way this is written up that he's more of a compatibilist, which I'm not really much in that vein. But it could be a very interesting talk in some ways, anyhow, as Ethan was mentioning about the event in Chilliwack.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are our skeptical highlights. Remember to check them out on radiofreethinker.com. We'll have all of our show notes and everything.
Ethan, we had an interesting email recently about someone who was questioning a bit about the diversity on our show, and just sort of as a closing sort of comment, I kind of agree. I think we do deserve a bit of diversity on here, and I'd like to throw open that if anyone is interested to participate, to join in, to add some comments, you don't have to come into the show live. We can do Skype interviews or that sort of thing. We'd be interested to hear from you. If you think you want to add to the show, if only on a sporadic notion, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com and let us know if you want to participate in this skeptical adventure that me and Ethan have been on for, God, forever now.
Yeah, really long time. And it's such an adventure, too. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.